We really should have thought of a title. Did we have any ideas for a title that I've forgotten?
I do not think so. I think that that was one of the few things that we neglected to think about.
Yeah, just a few things.
Yeah, just a couple.
Hello, and welcome to the 90s Movies podcast that we haven't thought of a title for, starring me and Anne. I'm Brendan. This is Anne.
I'm Anne. Hi.
My name's James Vanderbeek, and I'm sorry.
To start off our inaugural episode, we decided to watch what's known as a classic to literally no one, the movie Varsity Blues, starring James Vanderbeek in his breakout film role that, you know, launched the fine film career he has today.
Right.
Do you remember when that came up, that we decided to watch that in particular?
I don't. I think you chose it.
I probably
because
did.
Because I believe neither of us had seen it before. Is that correct? Had you seen it before?
No, I had seen it before. I had absolutely seen it before.
Oh, no. Then no, I have no idea why this was the choice. I don't.
I mean, I hadn't seen it since like college. It had been a solid 16 years.
I don't know that this... I had seen a couple scenes from it, but never the film itself. I don't know that this would have been my choice, but maybe because it was such a gap in my 90s movie knowledge, I just wanted to be educated.
Well, yeah, it comes up all the time in discussions about nothing at all, ever.
Yeah. People are always saying, you know, this is just like that scene from Varsity Blues.
Yeah, the part where he has a pig in his truck and chugs a bottle of maple syrup. Do you want to talk about a plot summary for this movie?
I think that is probably a pretty great place to start. I believe that the film opens with our young hero, James Vanderbeek, whose character's name I can't recall. So
I don't either. It might also have been James.
That would make a lot of sense.
I hope it is. I don't believe it is. In my notes, I just referred to him as James Vanderbeek.
I think that's safe. Let me look it up really fast. Okay, it's Mox.
Mox. Oh, that's right. Which is not a person's name. It's the name of a kind of soda at best.
Okay.
Or like a cleaning product from the 50s.
So we see Mox, who's like, I guess he's supposed to be an intelligent, sensitive, but somehow kind of a smart-ass douchey type guy.
Yeah.
But he's on the football team, which is important, but he's always on the bench.
That's right. That's how I was thinking about this. That's how the device you use to make the quarterback of the champion football team make seem like the underdog is that you get the backup quarterback who has to jump in, which is also the same plot of Friday Night Lights.
This is almost exactly the same as Friday Night Lights, which I commented to you while we were watching it, and you were like, Anne, but this was from the 90s, and apparently that book was written in like 1994. So
wait, really? I did not go to look that up.
Yeah, I did. I was correct. But anyway, so the star quarterback gets injured, and James Vanderbeek / Mox has to be pulled in, and it just changes his world. Suddenly, he's pulled into this fast world of football and girls and
local fame in a small Texas town.
Yeah, and it just partially threatens his relationship, and maybe I don't think his family are at stake. The stakes are very low.
His relationship with his father is at stake, but yes, they are not significant. Like, the worst case scenario, I think, is that late in the film, I don't want to jump ahead, but late in the film, he is threatened with losing his scholarship to an Ivy League university.
That's like somehow
the lowest point.
Yeah. I don't understand how he got into an Ivy League university. Definitely his relationship with his girlfriend is threatened. And there's this whole backstory about the crooked coach who's somewhat responsible for the original quarterback's injury and is like too hard on the kids. That's the one part that's not Friday Night Lights-esque, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the coach is absolutely the villain.
John Voight.
Yeah.
I mean,
he does the best he can with that role. I think he pretty much owns
it. Yeah, he really acted the shit out of it.
We do things around here my way. You understand that? You think you're in some fancy school? Bullshit. You show me the kind of smarts, makes me wonder if you know the difference between a sneeze and a wet fart.
I do want to note two things about the beginning, which is first, the first line of the movie is, in America, we have laws. Said in James Vanderbeek's best Texas accent. He spent hours with a recording of a dialect coach. And also, this movie was produced by MTV Productions.
Oh.
And won an MTV Movie Award, if I recall correctly. I think for something to do with, what's her face? Not,
Allie
there were
Larder.
Two. Allie Larder. Something to do with her famous scene from this movie that was lampooned in numerous spoof films.
We'll get into that. I was trying to look up what the MTV Movie Award was, and I wrote MTV Movie Award Friday Night Lights.
Maybe like people who are from Texas can have a lot of nuance and ability to distinguish between 90s football movies about small town Texas, but
okay, so I don't. James Vanderbeek won Best Breakout Performance.
That's right.
That was the winning element of this film.
I'm going to start a film company and then a film awards company and give awards to my own movies. I think it seems like a tidy little circle.
I'm actually surprised that John Voight was in this. There were a lot of familiar faces, I think, in this film between him.
There were.
Allie Larder and, of course, Vanderbeek. That woman who was in The Butterfly Effect, she was in this.
I haven't seen Amy Smart.
Amy Smart, yeah.
Yes. And of course, Paul Walker.
Paul Walker. As the quarterback who is injured.
Yes. He was born for the role. He has 8 lines and just looks pretty.
I think it's the exact same character he played in She's All That, actually.
Yes. And probably the movie about She's All That that was not She's All That. Sort of a spoof movie that wasn't really a spoof
movie. Not another teen movie?
Not another teen movie.
Oh, that was absolutely a spoof movie. But Paul Walker wasn't in that.
He wasn't?
I don't think so.
We're going to look this up after the show.
No, it was some guy who was made to look like Paul Walker. My original motivation, I just want to say really fast, for watching all these 90 movies was that I wanted to have Brendan and our friend Kat watch Not Another Teen Movie, but it turned out we hadn't all seen all of the movies that are referenced. So in order to provide context, we watched Cruel Intentions, She's All That. I can't remember if we watched anything else or if we were just...
Building up to the masterwork, the omnibus, if you will.
Of Varsity Blues.
Of Not Another Teen Movie.
Yeah. So one day we're going to watch Not Another Teen Movie unless it's just too horrible. You know who was in Not Another Teen Movie? The guy who played Billy Bob.
Oh, we'll get to him. Billy Bob, the real breakout character of this movie. And
a
fascinating person in his own right. His name, remember his name.
Ron Lester.
Ron Lester.
Also played the same character in Not Another Teen Movie, I believe, with the pig in the pickup truck. And it was essentially just the exact same role.
I love that dog.
I think it's a pig.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to say is that Paul Walker's character name in the movie is Lance Harbor, which is just two nouns that sound strong. That's just, they like pulled those out of a bingo ball cage.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good douchey guy name.
Buck Tackle.
To be fair, his name is Paul Walker.
Yeah, but at least it's not like Strong Walker or Ryder Strong, another real 90s person. So, okay, the plot of the movie, Mox has to come off the bench after Paul Walker's injured because the coach is pushing him too hard. He wants to just sit on the bench and read his Kurt Vonnegut novel and have his alternative girlfriend, played by Amy Smart, and just get through high school and then get a scholarship to Brown University, which they advertise very heavily in this movie. Mm-hmm. But complications ensue.
Am I supposed to jump in?
I was like, yeah, this is an alley-oop where you take over the plot summary.
Man, I was not...
If you remember it.
...really listening to you.
I'm just setting up the first act.
Okay. And did you cover Paul Walker's injury yet?
I did.
Oh, shit. I don't remember it that well after that point. I remember Paul Walker's girlfriend, after James Vanderbeek becomes a star quarterback, he saves the team amid what looks like going to be a loss, and he becomes the hero of the town. Paul Walker's girlfriend starts hitting on him pretty openly.
Like on the same night that they're in the hospital with him.
Mm-hmm.
She's like changing in his car. The movie's relationship with sex is really fascinating. Like many movies, it wants to titillate you while also kind of being a little prudish or moralizing about the dangers of loose women. But between Ali Larter's kind of positioned as the sluttier alternative to Amy Smart, who has dark hair and wears an Ankh necklace and pants.
Yeah, very baggy, like baggy 90s clothes, essentially.
Yeah.
She's not sexy at all. She's very cute. But
she's very
not
cute.
Super sexy. Whereas Ali Larter, I think in the beginning, insinuates that they're going to have sex on the washing machine and it's somehow very sexy. Or dryer? I don't remember.
No, they do. They start having sex on the washing machine at a party.
Her saying, let the dryer do the work.
That's
and
right.
And ever since, I've been trying to figure out how that would happen.
I think it's just... It's supposed to, they turn it on and it vibrates. I don't know.
Yeah, but she wouldn't be up against that vibration if they're having sex.
Maybe it just bounces. Maybe she just like, neither one of them has to move because the dryer induces motion in some way.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, she's clearly set up to be this very sexualized character. The iconic scene with the whipped cream bikini, which also yes. I've thought about a lot since because it doesn't make any sense because where is that going to go? Like, where from there?
It's going to go to yeast infection land on both parties.
Can you imagine having sex with somebody who's covered in whipped cream?
Like, what's the best case scenario that you, like, you eat it all off?
And then I don't know. That's a lot of whipped cream.
And it starts to, you know, I mean, it warms up. It starts to smell like warm milk.
At some point, because he rejects her and she kind of, like, sits down on the couch... And yeah. I couldn't help but wondering, like, how is she sitting down right now?
Yeah, we were both like, ooh, couch, no.
Well, and, like, also, you kind of have to slouch at least a little bit when you sit down, and she's got these giant... Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it was very implausible. Next time, 90s movie, I would prefer it if, you know, your teen characters were sexualized in a more plausible way.
So we brought up two things there, one of which is 90s fashion, which gets very real in this movie very fast. They all wear terrible, terrible clothes. James Vanderbeek in particular tends to wear these kind of baggy, long-sleeved, low-waisted shirts with like a stripe across the chest, which I think of very specifically as a thing my brother wore every day for about 8 years. And also just baggy straight leg jeans that just kind of puddle around his feet.
Mm-hmm.
And which... Like, his proportions are kind of weird anyway. His head is so big that with the shirt that goes down to, like, mid-thigh and the jeans that just are baggy around his feet, it makes him look like a bobblehead
mm-hmm.
whenever he's not in a football uniform. They did not do good for things for him in that way. Oh, also, a lot of boys wear necklaces, like puka shell necklaces.
I feel like I remember a lot of crop top-esque shirts on the boys.
Well, that's true.
Too. It might have just been football tops with, like, I don't know. What do you call that? Football pads?
A jersey?
Yeah, well, like a jersey with, like, the football pads underneath. And so there was
one character in particular, Skeeter, who I think does wear crop tops at some point.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of frosted tips.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's the other thing they did to those poor young men.
Yeah. But yeah, it was. I feel like at least a very good representation of 90s fashion.
Mm-hmm. It was bad, but it was genuine.
Yeah. It really makes it into a piece out of time.
Oh, well, we were talking about the movie's relationship to sex. There's a whole subplot with their teacher.
Oh my god!
Do you remember this? Yeah,
I meant to bring it up, and I forgot.
The sex ed teacher, which fact that they have. Sorry, go ahead.
I couldn't tell if they were trying to make her sexy or not, because she seemed very not sexy, But then obviously it became apparent that they were trying to make her sexy. I'm not sure.
They really kind of wanted to have it both ways. Mm-hmm. Like they were, they treated her like an object, but then also like a comedy foil. Yeah. But then also you wanted, they wanted to look at breasts. Yeah, they have a scene set in a sex ed class, which having even an hour of sex ed, as you pointed out, is unrealistic for a Texas small town high school. Mm-hmm. Where James Vanderbeek just names different slang terms for penises, for erections, for like 5 minutes.
And like 90% of them are made up.
Yes.
Flesh rocket, Jack's magic beanstalk, tall Tommy, mushroom on a stick, Mr. Mushroom head, purple-headed yogurt slinger.
The scene has no point. I don't understand what role it's trying to play in the narrative. Like, he knows a lot of sex jokes. This is what you devoted 5 minutes of your 90-minute running time to?
Right. And it's, I mean, there are things, I think the thing is, though, that, like, with teens, that could kind of slip by. Like, the sex references don't actually have to be real because they're going to pretend like they are in order to seem like they're point. Cool. But yeah, all of them are made up. It didn't make any sense. But the sex ed class introduced this teacher who we later come into contact with again when all of the football guys go to a strip club. I think it's the night before a big game. It's not even it after is. A big game. It's the night before a big game. We realize that the teacher is one of the strippers and plays a teacher in her strip club routine. And she's not a very good stripper.
Not at all.
The worst part of it.
She's like any character but a teacher. You gotta keep it a little bit on the down low.
Yeah.
Especially when you know, like, you have to know if they allow 18-year-olds in strip clubs around here routinely when they're part of the football team, you're gonna bump into the people on your football team.
Yeah.
While stripping as a teacher at the local strip club. But then they become like buddies with her.
Yeah.
And then Billy Bob asks her to prom.
Yep. They drank with her all night, and then they're like, you're not going to say anything, are you? Or that's what she says to them. Yeah. I don't know if it's implied if she sleeps with them or not. I'm just not sure.
I don't recall.
But yeah, that was a very odd twist in the movie that made it almost into a teen sex comedy, but it wasn't quite.
I just wanted to dabble in that. I just wanted to dip a toe before getting back to the extremely generic football movie plot. Yeah.
So go on. What happened next?
I don't remember what order or anything.
Oh, yeah. We finished the summary a while ago.
They steal a cop car at some point. There's a number of rape jokes. Billy Bob gets concussed and gets pushed into playing anyway by the coach and then maybe refuses and gets kicked off the team, and James Vanderbeek sticks up for him. Also, there's like a little nod to racial justice. Do you remember this?
Where
there's the running back
black character. Is that what you're referring
to? the black character, who is the running back who never gets any passes thrown to him, or at least not for touchdowns.
That's right.
They run him for yards, but then he doesn't ever get to make the touchdown. So James Vanderbeek says, "No, you know what? I will throw you a pass for a touchdown." He's like, "You're okay. You're my good white friend. You're a good guy." Buddy arm punch.
Yeah. That's how you know that James Vanderbeek is a good guy.
I remember watching the movie years and years ago, and I did not relate to the character, but I found it fairly engaging. And I found him, I was young. Give me a break. I found him a sympathetic hero, even if I didn't relate to him personally. Like, all right, this is a good dude. He's doing his best. Watching it again, I disliked him intensely. Mm-hmm. He's just a little fuck.
He's a fuck. He's a complete asshole. What we would call emo back in the day, but like not in an engaging or interesting way. And he's just thinks he is the smartest child in the room.
He's just a douche bro.
Yeah.
I got the feeling that either the director or the screenwriter, at some point, somebody had a very specific agenda. Like, they wanted to make a movie about their point of view, having grown up in a place like this, where they are not only the quarterback of the football team, but also the genius who goes to go to Ivy League, and all the ladies want to bone him. And, like, there are little specific details that made me think this is somebody's, some asshole's really personal story. Like the fact that he specifically wants to go to Brown, and the bit with his religious little brother subplot that had nothing to do with anything.
That was a very strange comedic relief. And his parents were just like, oh, well, he's starting a cult.
Well, he's a Muslim now, which would not have not play after the 90s were over.
Yeah, it was very, it did seem like weirdly personal, like somebody's wet dream about their high school experience, how it should have been.
Exactly. Which also makes the whipped cream bikini make more sense.
Yeah, a lot more sense. I'm looking at pictures of it right now, and I just can't. It's so hard to understand. The culmination, the movie culminates in this final football game, of course. There's like seven football games in this movie.
And there's no defensive line, by the way. the same team that is running offense just goes out there and then tries to do interceptions and tackles. They don't have a great grasp on football.
And
neither do
I. Didn't notice that. But the final game, the music swells and Foo Fighters' Hero starts playing.
That's right.
And it's so fucking iconic. In a weird way that even as an adult watching it, I'm like a little bit inspired. But that same thing that you can tell it's just somebody's wet dream. It's like, who would put the song Hero in a football?
Which is a sarcastic song, by the way, if you listen to the lyrics. Yeah. It doesn't sound like it. And in that context, certainly it was not intended to be. But there's some irony underlying him saying, there goes my hero. Yeah. That just instead, all you see is James Van Der Beek in slow motion with sweat and dirt and throwing the football.
Doing football.
And they like win the big game on a trick play because they had to sell it to a non-football audience, I guess.
I don't recall that at all.
That's where Billy Bob says, remember, I just wander down the field and act like I'm lost.
Oh my God.
And I throw the touchdown pass to him. He's not a receiver. I don't know if he's a legal receiver in football, but yeah, that's the concluding game winning touchdown.
Well, great.
Like the movie ends right there. Like they win the game, walk off the field, and do a little voiceover epilogue, and it's over.
Yeah, that's right. There's no like going to Brown. There's no like, and none of this ended up mattering at all.
Yeah.
It's, that's where it ends. I totally forgot. I think that about covers the film, honestly.
Well, that's right. The other triumphant moment is they kick the coach, they kick John Voight out of the locker room.
That's right.
Because they won't let him inject any more people with lidocaine or whatever.
They have a coup.
To keep them playing.
Yeah.
They perform a coup and Lance Harbor comes back and coaches for them on crutches. Another very specific thing that happens in Friday Night Lights.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they're trying to get this message after all the confusion of whatever the hell they were doing for most of the movie. They're like, and kids should be the boss of kids, the end.
Right. Don't let my high school football adults coach inject you with things.
Yeah.
Seems like
only world. Inject yourselves, kids.
Yeah. So what I learned most from this film was directly after we finished watching it and we were still on the phone, was doing a little bit of research, kind of a where are they now, and finding out.
If you're listening to this, I want you to brace yourself because we're about to go to a dark place.
Ron Lester is the actor who played Billy Bob. Billy Bob, he was 28 years old when this movie was filmed, playing an 18-year-old.
And did we find out how much he weighed at the time? Like how heavy he kept himself for roles like
this? I think that's just how heavy he kind of was. He was 350-ish pounds, I think.
Yeah.
And that's just who he was. And he, in Not Another Teen Movie, played exactly the same character. And I think he kind of started having trouble finding roles after that. And he had a gastric bypass surgery, lost like 200 pounds, and then could not get another job for the rest of his life. He's just a guy now, and he's very aware of the fact that Varsity Blues is his best and only movie. His social media accounts all reflect that.
Oh.
I don't know if you want to weigh in on poor Ron Lester.
It was real rough because, like, I think we found his Facebook fan page where he posts semi-regularly, as well as his personalized website. that he had when he was like trying to get his career restarted. And I think he does like, he does teaches classes. He teaches acting sometimes.
He does. He teaches acting. And it's all Varsity Blues stuff. And you can tell that nobody else from Varsity Blues speaks to him ever.
No. John Voight does not return his calls.
The banner behind Ron Lester, actor/director, is Billy Bob from the movie, and like in the middle there's a giant picture of the pig. His description of himself on his Facebook page is actor, director, producer, and stand-up comic, best known as 508-pound Billy Bob number 69 in the hit movie Varsity Blues.
When you have to say best known on your own fan site that you created, things have gone badly for you. And clearly he's tried to branch out. He's tried to work in other areas of the entertainment industry. I don't know. I think it seems like to me he had a taste of fame, a taste of that cult of personality.
Yeah.
And did not develop a lot of skills outside that or life outside that.
All of his Facebook posts have like 20 to 40 likes. If that.
Which I mean, that's more than I have, to be clear.
I don't know about that. And they're all kind of extremely personal.
Yeah. I remember, like, there was a series where he tweeted about things with his fiance, but he never tweets anything about his wife.
Oh, here's one of his posts from January 25th. There's only been my one love in my pathetic life, and she...
Oh, God.
She hunts me in my dreams every night.
No.
Wedding bells.
Ron.
Carousels. Fairy dreams. Overtures. Open doors. And me. She was the first love and the only person that completed me. I'll never find another one like her. Oh, sorry. I'll never find another like her.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, kiddo.
Yeah. So it's a lot like that. And that has two likes.
I mean, it would be one thing if he had been a teenager when he kind of hit this peak and then had trouble recovering from it. Mm-hmm. But as you pointed out, he was 28. Like, he was a full-grown adult who had lived a life and started, you know, his career before even reaching the point of what he is now best known for.
Here's another one from January 18th. I really want to make a movie called Confederate of Dunces. It's a one of, and the last I heard, quote, Drew Barrymore had the option on the book rights. Does anyone know how to reach out to her?
Oh, this is physically painful to think about.
That's his Facebook fan page. Sorry, I'm done reading. I could just do an entire day of reading Ron Lester's Twitter. Oh, no, Twitter,
we don't forget, but his website, his official website, that he clearly paid somebody. I would guess, having done things like this before, he paid several thousand dollars for somebody to design a website for him and install forum software. And there are two forums on Ron Lester, I don't know, actor.com. I don't remember the URL.
Oh, my God. It's ronlester.net.
Ronlester.net.
I'm...
Whew. And yeah, they are not popular forms.
I'm going to try to find it. Yeah. Okay. So if you go to his website and you click on Ron Lester Fan Club, there's three different forums. The top one is general talk about Ron Lester or anything else. The next one is
general talk about Ron Lester,
career discussions about all aspects of Ron's career. And the third one is in the wild. Have you met Ron in person? Share your stories and pictures here. The only one with any posts is the general forum. It has two posts. And one of those is the forum rules. And then the other one,
which are crucial.
The other one is an anonymous that just says, I really liked this site and I really love the pics and bio. Which is 1 month after the forum rules were posted.
which was either Ron Lester or the person he paid to make this website, testing to make sure that it was not broken.
You know, he's seeing these hits over the last, like, 2 months that we've been doing this. And he's getting really excited. Things are picking up.
Gonna check these referral logs.
Oh, no. But, yeah, that page, it's just the saddest thing ever. Ron Lester fan club and these empty forums.
I have a very clear idea of what he was expecting to happen when he set up this website, like what world he imagined, and it didn't come true. Mm-mm. And that it honestly, it might hurt me worse than it hurts him to know that's how it worked out.
I don't want your life.
One more thing. We talked about Friday Night Lights. The other connection to Friday Night Lights is that Jesse Plemons, who plays Landry on Friday Night Lights, is in it for two shots. He's like somebody's younger kid at a barbecue. And it was, when I saw him, I got spooked. I was like, all football is the same. This is a closed loop. Everybody's the same person. But no, he was just, you know, I think he probably grew up in Texas. And so they probably, well, they cast him. That's
all. That probably makes sense. Or he played football.
Do we want to wrap this up?
Yeah, I think that pretty, I can't think of anything else to talk about for there. Honestly, I'm shocked we were able to talk this long about Varsity Blues.
We're talking about more than Varsity Blues, right? We're talking about all the things that engage us in the context.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's part of this kind of sea of assumptions in 90s movies in particular, 90s boy movies that are just, you know, at the time watching these, I didn't see at all.
Yeah.
And now looking back at them, it's startling.
I do actually have a question really fast just to wrap it up. Are there still teen movies now? Because I feel very much like at every age I'm at, the media pretty much caters to me. And I'm not sure if that's just because that's what I'm seeing, but like the movies, like now the movies I'm seeing are like Neighbors and stuff like that, where it's like, oh, having a kid and coming to terms with the fact that you're kind of getting older, whereas like when Superbad came out, it was very much like kind of grad school, college time, and Varsity Blues was like middle school, high school. I just don't know if there's like still teen comedies and teen dramas and all that kind of stuff movie wise
the teen movie in particular, I think, is a phenomenon that has kind of passed, because that audience has been diverted into two things, which are sadness porn. Like Fault in Our Stars and If I Stay and Mean Earl and the Dying Girl, and genre films, because there are a lot of teen-focused YA novel-based adaptations and things like that that are directed very specifically at teens that take up that kind of function of, you know, the Bildungsroman plot where the protagonist kind of defines themselves and finds love and mm-hmm. triumphs in some way. The more easygoing comedy version of the teen movie, it's not so much a thing.
Yeah. Or just like, here's a thing that's just for teens. It seems like even now those movies, like the ones, all the pretty much all the ones you cited, and Hunger Games and, well, you know, all that stuff, Twilight, those are like things that are very popular with adults. It's not something that's just for teens, whereas the 90s teen movies really did seem to be just for teens. I don't think you would really catch our parents watching those or adults going, like, to see American Pie.
No, that's a good point.
I'm wrong.
Yeah.
So it seems like there was a lot of things that were created like for us, whereas I wonder if that's really happening now for teenagers.
You might be right. I mean, there was definitely a sentiment that being a teenager is inherently interesting. Mm-hmm. Without genre elements, without any kind of driving force, like sadness porn. But that has faded a bit, I think.
Which isn't a terrible
maybe
thing,
because,
but... Yeah.
No, I agree. Especially because so many of these films were focused on a very specific, you know, white, heterosexual, relatively affluent slice of life.
Yeah.
And just kind of assumed that as a default. I don't know. Maybe it has to do with budgets. Maybe just the fact that at the time, you could shoot one of these relatively cheaply, because all you have to do is get some starlets who will work cheap and come up with a plot and shoot it over the course of 2 months. And now special effects are a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. And so you can do your genre film and assume that you'll get a bigger audience and a bigger return for, you know, not much more money.
That's true. This, the budget for this, by the way, $16 million. Opening weekend made $17.5 million.
There you go, man. Yep. Good work, Varsity Blues.
All right.
Good work, James.
Good work, James.
I want to ask you one more thing, which is I want you to rate this movie on a scale of 1990 to 1999.
Yeah, I'm going to have to give this a 1991. It was really rough. I honestly, it was this weird mix of being boring and also mildly off-putting and offensive.
I would give it a 1994 myself, but I think a lot of that is just the familiarity of it, because I had a bit of nostalgia for it. Not that I found it in any way endearing upon rewatch, but it fed a little bit into that, like, all right, this is a movie, I can watch it.
I feel like I could have basically the same experience just listening to the Foo Fighters without having to see all of that.
Yeah, the Foo Fighters are definitely 1998.
Oh, yeah, for sure.